It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Last fall, concerns about water and air quality prompted the Eau Claire County Board to adopt a moratorium on creation or expansion of large-scale livestock operations. Last week, the County Board voted to extend that moratorium while a committee is looking at the issues and completing its work. We're going to find out why the moratorium was originally put in place, why it was extended, and what the study committee has discovered. Also, what might be proposed. Western Wisconsin, we want to hear from you. Are you aware of this moratorium? Do you support it? Why or why not? If you're an owner, operator, or employee of a large scale livestock farm, we'd like to hear from you. How has this moratorium had an impact on your plans? And farmers, what changes are you willing to make to aid access to clean water in your community? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rod Esslinger is the Director of Planning and Development for Eau Claire County. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
And Greg Leonard is the Land Conservation Manager for Eau Claire County. He leads the Committee on the Large-Scale Livestock Facility Moratorium for Eau Claire County. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
Rod, let's start with you. Explain for us what this moratorium regulates.
Well, the moratorium was put into place last October at the passage by the county board, and essentially what it does is that it put a stayed on any expansion or creation of large livestock facilities in Eau Claire County specifically.
And Greg, why was this moratorium considered necessary?
Well, in essence, though, the moratorium really only affected large-scale livestock facilities defined as anything over 1,000 animal units. As far as necessary, the moratorium itself was just to give us as a county a little bit of time to review our existing ordinances, which we knew needed some updating, and for us to study options available to the county to move forward.
And who was bringing these concerns about large-scale livestock operations to the county? Who was pushing for the moratorium?
Essentially, the the interest sparked, I would say, probably about a year and a half to 2 years ago, and it really more came together last spring, and it was a group of citizens, along with several county board members, that that it really started with, and a couple county board members brought the an ordinance together, or the moratorium together, and we met several times, and eventually that we brought it through the Eau Claire County Committee on Planning and Development, and eventually that worked its way. The ordinance then was presented to the county board on October. But along with that, there is, you know, we worked with the interest groups and the county board members to make sure that, you know, as far as language and assisted a little bit as from a staff's perspective.
If I may add, Rod, one of the things that our Land Conservation Commission, who's the oversight for our Land Conservation Office, one of the things that the commission wanted to do was to begin the process for updating our animals waste storage ordinance and consider additional ordinances or rules for the county. And this was actually coming about at the same time that the citizen members brought forth the moratorium. So actually the two processes kind of meshed together very well.
Let's talk about the water quality situation in Eau Claire County. What's the situation regarding surface water and groundwater and its relationship, if any, to large-scale livestock operations?
Well, for the surface water, we do have a mixture of water quality within Eau Claire County. We have some exceptional water bodies for surface water, some very nice trout streams within the county. But we do have also some streams which are impaired for phosphorus runoff, and we're aware of those issues. So in general, Eau Claire County has got a mix, but in essence, we do have fairly nice water quality here in Eau Claire County. Groundwater is another story. It's a little bit harder to track. We do not have a comprehensive countywide study on our groundwater quality. As a matter of fact, last year, our Groundwater Advisory Committee had published a report, the state of the groundwater in Eau Claire County, and one of the primary recommendations for groundwater quality is to try to complete a comprehensive study of our groundwater quality across the county. And in average, there was a recent Wisconsin Counties Association publication. Basically, our groundwater quality across the compared to other counties across the state, we're average or slightly better than average.
We're talking about the balance between farm expansion and water quality management, looking at one Wisconsin county strategy, Eau Claire County. Rod Esslinger is with us. He's the Director of Planning and Development for Eau Claire County. Greg Leonard is also helping us understand the situation. He's the Land Conservation Manager for the county. Are you an owner, operator, or employee on a large-scale livestock farm? Has this moratorium had an impact on your plans? Farmers, what changes are you willing to make to aid access to clean water in your community? And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Rod, the initial moratorium was passed last fall. Why was an extension necessary?
Excellent question. When we look back at the timeline, we put together somewhat of an aggressive schedule for us, and we've been meeting since last November. And we had one meeting canceled due to weather, and we wanted to make sure that we were able to look at all the particular topics that related to surface water, animal waste handling and disposal, livestock siting, CAFO. We also wanted to take a look at the administrative rules in the state of Wisconsin. So the committee that was studying, they understood all different aspects of the topic. So we wanted to make sure that we educated. That process really is taking up the entire 6 months. Why is it essential to expand or extend the moratorium? Really, that is for the creation and then the passage of the actual ordinances. And actually, Greg has been working on some of those ordinance developments. Currently, we've been reviewing other ordinances, animal waste ordinances from the different parts of the state. And so when we look back, we knew that the moratorium was expiring in April. And then we said, well, what is it going to take to really get us to a county board meeting with an ordinance where they can pass it? And so we identified what that date was, and we had to back it up. And knowing that we had to have a first reading, we had to have a public hearing in front of the Committee on Planning and Development. We're also working closely with our Land Conservation Committee. So with those things in play, we wanted to make sure that we have the legislative bodies informed. So those are, that's really the reason why we had to back up there.
All right. Well, we're going to continue our conversation about Eau Claire County's moratorium what's next. We're talking about how one Wisconsin county is dealing with the balance between farm expansion and water quality management with Rod Esslinger and Greg Leonard. We'd like to know what you think about how Eau Claire County is handling this. 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, and for Kate Archer Kent, it's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about the balance between farm expansion and water quality management, taking a look at one Wisconsin county strategy. Rod Esslinger is with us. He's the Director of Planning and Development for Eau Claire County. Greg Leonard is also helping us understand the situation. He's the Land Conservation Manager for the county. What do you think? Are you an owner, operator, or employee on a large-scale livestock farm? Are you a citizen of Eau Claire County with concerns about water quality and how manure is handled? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Greg, let's talk a little bit about how manure is handled and stored and where that fits into your management equation.
Well, excuse me. Well, manure on multiple farms is handled in many different ways. Smaller operations still do, for dairy operations, actually have a daily haul type situation. Poultry operations typically just have the manure within the chicken coop and it's hauled out every once in a while. Larger dairy operations eventually, though, tend to go towards having manure storage. So manure storage is something that's regulated underneath our animal waste storage ordinance for the construction design of the manure storage facility. It does have to meet our federal standards for the design criteria. For the management of the manure when it comes out of the manure storage pit, we have what's known as a nutrient management plan that needs to be followed. The nutrient management plan is developed to consider the nutrient availability of what's in the manure, applying it onto cropland fields so that it matches the needs of the crops, take into consideration the surface water that we're not allowing runoff to occur into the surface water. There's also considerations for groundwater protection. There's setbacks from private wells, larger setbacks from municipal wells. If there's any fractured bedrock near the surface or any other direct conduits to groundwater, there's setback areas surrounding those areas also for groundwater protection. There's also consideration this time of the year is a very significant runoff period. With melting snow, potential rain occurring on frozen ground, these are very significant time periods when we can have runoff events. So there's additional considerations at this time of year for trying to control runoff of manure.
Rod, how have the concerns of farmers and community members been included in the decision-making process surrounding this moratorium?
Their voice through the special ag committee that we've formed. With the formation of that, we wanted to make sure that we've got voices across the different agricultural community. So we have large, small, we have different type of producers. So we wanted to make sure that their voices were heard. We feel that the whole process has been transparent. Greg, when he holds the committee meetings, the sessions that we've had those sessions taped. We've created a website where we put all those meetings up and any material that were that was presented. That information is all available, and we wanted to be more inclusive, more transparent. We wanted to have individuals be part of this discussion because it does impact all of Eau Claire County, and we just wanted to have it be very, very much an inclusive process.
How have farmers responded to the moratorium? Have they just taken it in stride? Has this been limiting for them? What are they telling you?
Well, I don't believe that the moratorium has specifically been limiting directly for most of the farmers. We were in contact with some farmers prior to the moratorium actually being enacted. No one indicated that they had immediate plans that the moratorium would hold back their immediate business plans. There could be something out there that we're not aware of, but direct impact the moratorium, I don't think it was a significant impact on the local agriculture industry. We tried to keep the moratorium as short as possible, and we're trying to get the the process completed as quickly as possible to minimize any potential impact there might be.
Rod Esslinger and Greg Leonard work for Eau Claire County. They've been involved in a project to study, review, and update the manure management ordinances for Eau Claire County. Greg, talk a little bit more about what strategies already exist for managing agricultural runoff.
Well, as I've already kind of mentioned, we do have our animal waste storage ordinance, which does help us with the regulation of the design and installation of the manure storage facility. We also have nutrient management plans, which need to be followed for any of the manure that is coming out of those manure storage facilities. But what we also have in place is within Eau Claire County is we have farmland preservation, which is a program for farmers to receive a Wisconsin income tax credit. But in exchange for that income tax credit, they have to agree to follow the state's soil and water conservation standards. So we have over 250 participants in that program within the county. These farmers are voluntarily receiving the tax credit, but then voluntarily following those soil and water conservation standards. Those standards include the nutrient management plan requirements. It also includes controlling soil loss off of cropland fields so that we do not have excessive erosion off of the cropland fields. And also making sure that there's no overflow of manure storage facilities, making sure that the stream banks are protected from livestock. Not that the livestock have to be fenced out of the stream, but that they're not trampling the streams or causing erosion.
Rod, the strategy that Eau Claire County has used, a moratorium, kind of hit the pause button in order to study and learn more about what's going on and then developing some new ordinances in response to what you find. Is that a strategy that you would recommend to other counties who are looking to address and improve water quality?
Most definitely. This is the second moratorium that I personally been involved with in Eau Claire County. The first one was back in 2012 when we had a lot of frac sand mining that kind of spurred up at that time. It really gives the community an opportunity to take a look at their real concerns, issues that it pertains to that particular municipality or county in our case. It gives you an opportunity to have public involvement, which any time that you're writing restrictions or rules, that to have a really strong process, you want that public element there. You want an opportunity. You want to be transparent. You want a wide range of individuals. So I would encourage it if other counties are looking at considering this particular topic and getting studied. It sometimes it may not be a popular thing, but at the end of the day, when it's done, you can say that you've exhausted the process. You've included the individuals, you included the farmers, you included everyone that needs to be at the table. If you don't, when it comes time to get closer to writing the rules and bringing it forth in front of a committee and or a county board in our case, it's going to be difficult to get passage.
And Rod, have you heard from your counterparts in other counties around the state who may be looking at what you're doing and asking, okay, so you did this, what happened, how does that work out for you?
I personally have not. I know that currently there's our Pepin County, I believe, has a moratorium that's in place. But other than that, we're not aware of other moratoriums that's in place, and no other counterpart has reached out to kind of investigate how we're doing it from our end. Greg may have some other input there.
Yeah, Greg, what about you? Have you heard from your counterparts in other counties around Wisconsin?
Yeah, as Rod mentioned, Pepin County has recently extended their moratorium. They extended it for 6 months into September. From what I understand, that may lead into a change in their regulations for a livestock licensing ordinance. Dunn County last year had a moratorium, which led to their study. That now what they are doing right now is they've revised their manure storage ordinance. And it also helped for Dunn County to create an ad hoc committee to study groundwater concerns. So that's something that has happened. There's been a few other moratorium in the past across the county, resulted in typically a change in manure storage ordinance.
All right. Thank you both for joining me. Rod Esslinger, Director of Planning and Development for Eau Claire County. Thanks for being with us this morning. And Greg Leonard is the Land Conservation Manager for Eau Claire County. He leads the Committee on Large-Scale Livestock Facility Moratorium for Eau Claire County. Thank you both for joining us from our Eau Claire studios.
Thank you.
This
Thank you.
Morning. Thanks to Dean Kallenbach for coming in and producing this segment from Eau Claire. Coming up next, we hear from one of the journalists behind a new investigation into electronic health records and the issues facing those who rely on them. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. 10 years ago, President Barack Obama signed a law which was supposed to expedite the creation and adoption of electronic health records in the United States. These digital records were supposed to revolutionize healthcare, but there are growing concerns from the medical field that the system isn't working as intended, and in some cases, it's putting patients at risk. Erica Fry is a senior writer at Fortune magazine. She co-wrote the magazine's April cover story titled Death by 1,000 Clicks, where electronic health records went wrong. Erica, welcome to the Morning Show.
Thanks so much, John. It's good to be here.
First of all, just a chance for our listeners to get involved here. Do you work in the medical profession? Have you used health records software? And if so, does it make your life easier or harder? What's good about it? What's bad about it? What's made your life more difficult? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Erica, your story begins with an electronic health record system made by a company called eClinical Works. Talk about that example and how that sets the stage for the broader investigation you conducted.
Sure. So the example that we start the story with dates back to 2012, and a patient named Annette Monticelli, who lived in Vermont, was having terrible headaches, and she went to the doctor a couple of times. The doctor, on the second visit, had thought these were probably headaches, but had considered the idea that it may be an aneurysm, and she sent for a head scan, an MRA, that could test, you know, what was going on in Annette Monticelli's brain. 2 months later, Annette Monticelli died of an aneurysm, and she had never been tested for that condition and never been diagnosed for it. So, you know, there was this puzzle. The doctor had ordered a test that this patient hadn't got, and she died later. You know, it seems like that test could have discovered what the issue was. So that led to a government investigation. There's a few steps in between, but basically the software didn't seem to work how it was intended. The test didn't get sent to the lab, and, you know, it had patient consequences. And what the government found in its investigation was actually there were a number of issues with this software, including, you know, the fact that sometimes when you ordered a test or for a diagnostic image, there were several ways to order these images, but they wouldn't always go through. And this company, eClinical Works, ended up, you know, the government had alleged they had misrepresented their software, that it didn't work in the way it was supposed to work. And the eClinical Works settled those allegations for $155 million. With the government. There's been another electronic health records company that's also settled a similar case. So, you know, what we found is that these software systems that are involved in treating patients, you know, interact with or intersect with our lives, don't exactly work, or at least in some cases don't work exactly like they're supposed to, and there are safety implications to that.
Well, let's step back for just a second. In 2009, then President Obama signed the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health, or the High Tech Act. What was the original intent of this legislation?
Yeah, so the idea in 2009, a surprisingly few hospitals in the U.S., you know, used electronic systems in their record keeping. Only 9% of hospitals were using electronic systems. The rest were still using paper. And this was in 2008, 2009. You know, we had iPhones, we had all this technology. Most industries had been digitized and had seen some efficiencies from that. And so it made a lot of sense, you know, why in healthcare are we still depending on patient or on paper records? Wouldn't it be better if we could, you know, make these records transportable? Wouldn't it make medicine safer? Wouldn't it make it cheaper? Wouldn't it raise the quality of care if all of this was digitized? So that was the idea. At the time the financial crisis was happening, the Obama administration was looking for, you know, projects for the stimulus bill that would sort of kickstart the economy. The idea that electronic health records could really transform medicine was popular on both sides of the aisle. So this seemed like a really solid project for the government to put some money behind.
And yet you write that after 10 years, after President Obama signed the law, the federal government has sunk $36 billion into this effort and has very little to show for its investment. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that was, you know, what was really interesting to us, because everyone agreed this was a good idea. Now, there were people at the time who feared the technology wasn't ready for this massive transformation of the American healthcare system. That seems to be a factor. In 2009, the electronic health records industry was just a small $2 billion industry, like 700 some companies. And so this technology wasn't widely used. It wasn't well known, you know, how it would work if quickly implemented across America's healthcare system. And the other major factor was, you know, this was part of the stimulus bill. The idea was to spend money quickly. And so the government had a really quick timeline to get these systems out there, to get them adopted. And in the process, you know, there were a lot of requirements, but a lot of the companies couldn't meet those, or it was a real challenge to meet those requirements quickly. And for healthcare providers, they had to implement these systems really quickly. And this is a huge transformation. It really changes workflows. It changes the practice of medicine. So everyone was doing this extremely quickly, and that seemed to have some unintended consequences.
Erica Frey is a senior writer at Fortune magazine. We're talking about 10 years in, how the High Tech Act has performed, where we are with electronic medical records, and what some of the problems are. Erica, you're talking about a free-for-all here after the High Tech Act went into force. The result, you say in your article, is a sprawling, disconnected patchwork of electronic health records. And this is what really stood out for me. The proprietary record systems made by more than 700 vendors routinely don't talk to one another. Let's examine this for a little bit. I mean, was there no language in the law that said that if we're going to make medical records electronic and transportable, that the systems have to be able to communicate with each other?
Sure. Yeah, you would think. And interoperability, that's the term the industry uses, or the idea that these systems would talk to each other, that you could share the records no matter what system a hospital is using, you know, that was really a key part of the vision. And so when they crafted the requirements for hospitals and for EHR vendors, this was a goal that was set up for everyone to meet down the line. But the policy team thought that it was not fair to ask hospitals that didn't really even have electronic health record systems to make them share data right away. They had an expression, they have to operate before they interoperate, or they can't interoperate before they operate. So it was always part of the idea, but there was a feeling that it couldn't be achieved right away. And so it was deprioritized. And they did some things, like they required all the companies to use the same standard language, thinking that this would help down the road. But it just hasn't happened. It hasn't been a priority for healthcare providers or their clients, the EHR vendors.
Well, one of the big promises of electronic health records was that all of a patient's records could be in one place, which in many cases has happened, but that's also created some unintended consequences. Can you talk about the good and bad of having all this information in one place?
Yeah, and so cases where, you know, the records are all together, doctors who are using them say they're extremely hard to read. A lot of times, because it takes a long time to document things, physicians may cut and paste notes. And so there's just a ton of information in these systems. It hasn't been well organized. People say the systems are quite poorly designed in some cases. And so the challenge has been, okay, you have all this information. How do we find the really critical information, especially in, you know, cases where you might have a medical emergency where you really need to find one or two pieces of critical information? It can be really difficult.
I want to play a clip from former Vice President Joe Biden. In early 2017, Biden met with leaders from the healthcare industry, and one of the things they talked about was improving access to these records. Let's take a listen.
I was stunned when my son for a year was battling stage 4 glioblastoma. I couldn't get his record. I'm the Vice President of the United States of America. A lot of you are very cooperative. Couldn't get his records. It was a absolute nightmare.
So, Erica, the implication here is that if the Vice President of the United States has a hard time getting access to health records, it's got to be near impossible for the average citizen. What have you heard from patients who've tried to seek out this information?
Right. Well, so it is a mixed picture. Some, especially if you're going to a really big academic medical center, you may have more luck at getting your records. But even there, even at the very elite medical centers, it can be a struggle to get your records. You know, by law, providers are supposed to give patients their records in a timely fashion in the format that they choose, and for not very much money. And studies have been done, and usually patients, you know, there may be a delay in getting their records. Usually they can't get all of their records. They may have to pick them up in person or get them by fax or by CD-ROM. So it's really a mixed bag out there, but especially if you're trying to get records from one institution and share them with another, as Joe Biden and his son Bo were doing at the time, it can be a real challenge.
We're talking with Erica Fry, senior writer at Fortune magazine. Erica stays with us as our conversation about electronic medical records continues. What are your concerns? What have your experiences been with electronic medical records? Tell us about that. Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. 10 years ago, President Obama signed a law which was supposed to expedite the creation and adoption of electronic health records in the United States. These digital records were supposed to revolutionize healthcare, but there are growing concerns from the medical field that the system isn't working as intended, and in some cases, it's putting patients at risk. Erica Fry is senior writer at Fortune magazine. She co-wrote the magazine's April cover story titled Death by 1,000 Clicks, Where Electronic Health Records Went Wrong. Erica, one of the other big benefits of electronic health records was supposed to be that they were going to save patients money. Did that actually happen?
You know, it's too early to tell. The idea was that if we had a record and you could see what had happened, what sort of care had been given to a patient, then you wouldn't have to duplicate tests if you go to another doctor. That would really reduce a lot of the extra cost in the system. And because we still have this problem sharing records, and it's very hard to share the records between different healthcare providers, we really haven't realized those, you know, cost gains yet.
Well, let's take some calls. We've got people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Joe, who's calling us from Appleton this morning. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I think the medical record system's a good idea, except that as a patient, there's so much information out there, they don't tell you what it means. It doesn't tell you where you are in terms of being normal or abnormal. The billing system is atrocious. I mean, they just keep posting bills and posting bills. You don't know what's active, what's not. And second, and the other part is that I don't think that doctors can make sense out of it either. I've got four different doctors. I tell them to check my medical records to see what tests have been performed, and yet I'm still having to duplicate some of those tests, or they don't relate it to current treatments that they're trying to recommend to me. Therefore, I spend more money on doctor visits because they don't tell me at the visit what's supposed to happen. They want to get to know me. I got to pay a $50 copay for a specialist to just talk face-to-face to get to know the doctor. I tell them, go to the medical records, look at the treatments I'm getting, and then formulate some kind of strategy that we can talk about. I don't want to have a conversation. I don't want to have a $50 conversation with you just to get to know me.
Okay. Joe, thanks for the call. Erica, is Joe's issue pretty common or not?
Yes, definitely. We've heard that. Thanks for your comments, Joe. And it definitely we've heard from a lot of doctors and people that are working on this sort of the interoperability idea and the idea of sharing records. One of the big challenges is data quality and knowing, you know, is the data from one provider current? Does it make sense? They don't totally trust it, and so they'll often go ahead and do the tests again or, you know, have a conversation again to really learn on their own. They don't trust the data in the pre-existing records.
Joe, thanks for that call. Let's go to Tom in Port Wing next. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning. My question is in regards to the dark web. A credit card information is valued at about $5. Your healthcare information is valued at about $250. This demonstrates how valuable that information is. I want to know, how is it being protected? I don't think it's being protected.
Companies everywhere dealing with online security issues these days, Tom, bringing up that point, does that also include the healthcare software industry? And are there significant security concerns here?
Oh, definitely. As Tom said, you know, healthcare information is the most valuable that there is, I think, to all of us personally. And then, you know, on the dark web, it does sell at a much higher rate. And so all these companies, the government that's trying to make the system connect, everyone says privacy and security is really a top priority, a top concern. They're all working on it. And we have seen they don't get a ton of news because people don't, you know, want this to be in the news. But there have been ransomware attacks on hospitals where the data is held you know, hostage the same way with corporations. So there is some of that that's going on, but it's a huge concern, and there's a lot of work going on around, you know, protecting this data.
Tom, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Mark in Romance next. Mark, good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I know time is short. The thing that I'm most concerned about, I work in a hospital. We use the Epic record system, and I got to tell you, it is burning out colleagues. It's burned myself out. There's a term called moral injury that might be interesting for you guys to look at in a future program. But the problem that I find with the system is it is so complex. It is non-intuitive. You look at a screen, and it's like, okay, what do I do? And the simplest of things can take you through five or six different screens, and each screen is like a mishmash. I just don't understand why it can't be like a flow of things that you could click off or fill in the blank, but that's not the way it goes. And we have doctors who are retiring early, nurses who are retiring early, solely because they are exhausted by the electronic medical record system. And basically, you know, we raise issues and people shrug their shoulders, roll their eyes, and, you know, it's like, well, they're working on it. That's what we hear all the time. And late last week, I got locked out of the system, wound up not being able to get all my notes done. I already this morning on my iPhone got a notice of, you know, being reminded that I didn't get a note done. Well, I didn't get the note done because the system locked up again.
Mark, thanks so much for your call. Meanwhile, as Mark says, we're hearing more and more these days about physician burnout. Erica, what are you hearing from those people in the medical profession about how electronic records are contributing to that?
Yeah, I'm glad we heard from Mark. Sorry about his experience, but, you know, that is so common. You hear doctors that say, and nurses that say, you know, we're not Luddites. We know how to use technology. We use good technology. And then we come to work and we have these electronic health record systems, and they're so cumbersome. They're so clunky. We have to click, you know, thousands of times during the course of their shift. Everything that should be simple takes a very long time. It's hard to find information. So this is definitely an issue, and it definitely is linked by many people to the epidemic levels of burnout that's going on with the profession. There was a 2018 study that found, you know, 78% of physicians have suffered symptoms of burnout. So that's really, you know, burnout was named a public health crisis by the Harvard School of Public Health just earlier this year. So it's a huge issue that the profession's grappling with.
Is electronic health records the only issue here? Judy Faulkner, CEO of Epic Systems, which is based here in Wisconsin, says electronic health records are being unfairly blamed for physician burnout. What's her take on this?
Yeah, burnout is definitely not only caused by electronic health records. You know, there's a question of degree, but the whole practice of medicine has changed. In terms of, there's been a lot of consolidation in the industry. Physicians are now working for big health systems. So there are many things that have changed, but, you know, something you routinely hear, and as we just heard Mark tell us, is that a big point of frustration for them is the time that they have to spend on electronic health records. There was a study that found after work every day, the average doctor is spending 1.4 hours just doing their notes, spending time on the electronic health records, and they're not compensated for that time. So that's really frustrating, and they feel like this is not a meaningful use of their time either. They're not interacting with patients. They're interfacing with these really clunky systems that they have to get their notes into.
Very briefly, what would more oversight of this industry look like?
You know, that's a good question. There's a lot of debate on what that should look like. If the government gets involved with regulation, will that stop innovation? I think a lot of people are hoping for a model that's like in the airline industry, where there's a lot of attention paid to safety. Right now, with electronic health records, these errors are happening and no one is tracking them. No one's collecting them in any sort of database. So just some basic level of monitoring and sharing this information, I think, is what most people are hoping for.
Erica, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Erica Fry is a senior writer at Fortune magazine. She co-wrote the magazine's April cover story titled Death by 1,000 Clicks, where electronic health records went wrong. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.